It's a great pleasure to welcome Manuel Castells again for the second of his three lectures as the Humanitas professor in the media. And since I introduced him at some length yesterday, I won't do that again today. But for the benefit of those who weren't here yesterday, let me just say that he is the university professor and Wallace Annenberg Chair of Communication Technology and Society at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And he is also simply the most exciting and original scholar doing the most cutting-edge work today on the great communication revolution of our time. He's written many, many books, including the celebrated and much referred to trilogy called The Information Age. And he is also doing very original and very important work today on social movements in the internet age. He began yesterday by outlining his theory of network power that he develops in much greater detail in his book called Communication Power. And today he'll use that as the backcloth to present his current ongoing research on social movements in the internet age. He's going to begin today by talking about the Arab uprisings. And then next Monday, for the third and final lecture, he'll talk about the Indignado movement in Spain, about the Occupy Wall Street and Occupy London movements. And I would also remind you that there will be a symposium next Wednesday from 2 to 5:30 at the Palmerston Room in the Fisher Building in St. John's, and you're all very welcome to come, but we would ask you to register online on the crash site just so we know the numbers. Let me say finally, I'd like to thank Crash and everyone at Crash once again for all the hard work they put into making this possible, and to thank the Institute for Strategic Dialogue for also supporting this visiting professorship. So without further ado, I'd like all of you to join me in welcoming Manuel Castells again.
Good evening. Let's go into the heart of the matter, since between yesterday and what my dear friend John Thompson said today, you know more or less the sequence of the lectures that I am trying to present and to submit to, if possible, our interaction and dialogue. Today I will start with the analysis of social movements in the internet age, that will require some small introduction in terms of what is the internet. You know what is the internet? Yes, you know what is the internet. What is the internet culturally and organizationally and institutionally, which is different. Only in this context we can then proceed into my current research, which is really starting on the empirical analysis of what happened in the Arab revolutions and then the indignant movement in Spain and the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States, although there are many other movements. So today will be the analytical framing of internet and social movements, and then the presentation of the case studies on the Arab revolutions, and then on Monday we'll work on Spain and the United States. This is to say that this is ongoing research by definition. I have to change the analysis every day, because every time that the observation doesn't fit the theory, I don't throw away the observation, I throw away the theory. And also my topics change constantly, and not according to a plan, an academic 5-year plan or anything like that, but according to what's going on in the world. So a year ago, I did not know that I would be working on these particular topics. Yes, on social movements and internet and power relationships, because this has been for the last 10 years, but not on these specific ones. Beg your benevolence concerning very exploratory work in progress on a topic that is unfolding and evolving as we speak. Today started the clashes around Wall Street between the police and the demonstrators. The interesting thing is that what the demonstrators wanted to do is to block Wall Street. So they couldn't, but the police blocked Wall Street because no one could get through the police barrier. So that's how the system keeps shooting itself in the foot. Let's start from a broader framework in concerning what is the Internet and the importance of the Internet in transforming social movements, not as a technology, but as what I call material culture. Technology is material culture. It's ideas transformed in technological design to do things with it. So let's start by saying that meaningful, conscious communication is what makes humans human. This is it. That's what distinguishes, and I underline conscious, all right? Conscious. And therefore, any major transformation of the technology and organization of communication is fundamental for social change. And over the last four decades, the advent of the Internet and wireless communication networks have completely transformed the way we communicate in society at large. And the fundamental transformation has been the shift from what I call mass communication, what everybody calls mass communication, to what I call mass self-communication. This is from a system in which a message is sent from one to many with little interactivity, mass communication, to a system where messages are sent from many to many with systemic interactivity, at the same time with multimodality in chosen time, either real time or selected time, and so that the senders are receivers and receivers are the senders, and both have access to a multimodal hypertext that constitutes the endless changing backbone of the communication processes. This is the self, the mass self-communication. In short, internets and wireless networks. So in the network society, as I tried to argue yesterday, power is based on the control and programming of communication networks. And counterpower is based on the capacity to reprogram communication networks and reconfigure these networks to maximize the connection among social actors that challenge the dominant institutions and their networks. Power relationships have always been based on the control of communication and communication that feed, the neural networks that constitute our minds. And therefore, the rise of horizontal networks of communication has created a new landscape of social and political change by the process of disintermediation of governments and corporations in the control of the communication systems. Disintermediation is the key word. So this is the power of the network, because then social actors build their own networks on the basis of their projects, values, and interests. Yes, on platforms which are also corporate, on Facebook, etc. But they are in a special business, the business of selling free communication, or relatively free and fettered communication. The moment they depart from this business, they cannot make money. And as we will see in the analysis of social movements, all these internet corporations need to keep internet traffic flowing, because that's where their money is. Furthermore, in the current technological environment, the entry barriers to this industry are very low. A couple of kids with $10,000 can start a website anytime, anywhere. And if Facebook, as they had the idea at one point, wants to close and make people pay, in 1 week they had such a mass migration to all kind of other networks that Facebook said, no, sorry, it was a mistake. And if you want to see in the history of technology, was when some of you were not born, there was an important social networking site, AOL, right? AOL was so powerful, that they bought CNN, they bought Turner Corporation, not Turner, but ABC News, all these, not ABC, Turner bought AOL. AOL bought ABC News. On what? On the money that they were supposed to be worth of in the financial market. Well, that's powerful. Well, first, of course, that money was fictitious, as much of the money, and therefore disappeared, the value disappeared. But in addition, they tried to police the network. So MySpace came in and said, come on. And so MySpace blew out AOL with some freedom for teenagers to be unruly as much as they wanted. But when AOL tried to cater to other constituencies, sorry, when MySpace tried to extrapolate that, MySpace was taken over by other networks and other networks, etc. So we can discuss about the industry if you want, but at this point in analysis of the social movement, the only thing I want to say, the fact that corporations control the platform doesn't mean that they control the content and the traffic, because the genie is out of the bottle. And if they don't do it, someone else will do it and they will lose the business. Now, we know that the building of a local global communication network based on the internet has transformed communication. That's obvious. Just to give you a couple of statistical points of reference, in the first global internet survey in 1996 showed 16 million in the world internet users. Now it's 2.3 billion. But that's not the important thing, because internet slowed its development in the first years of the 21st century, because at one point, when wireless communication started, in the developing world and in the new industrializing world, China, etc., they stopped setting up landlines. There are no more landlines in the world except the major fiber optic net rings in the metropolitan areas. So it was a moment of lapse until wireless-based internet would catch up. And that was happening now, because the extraordinary revolution is wireless communication. And there, I can give you another little number. 1991, first survey of mobile phone numbers, not devices, numbers, subscribers in the world was, at that point, was 16 million. 16 million. The number of the internet at the beginning was 40 million. This was 16 million. So internet, 96, 40 million, now 2.3 billion. Mobile subscribers in 1991, 16 million. Now, 5.7 billion, the latest, which with a multiplicative factor, very conservative estimate, means that way over 80% of the world population, if we eliminate children under five, that for the time being don't have their personal number, it's about 85% of the world population is now connected wirelessly. And of course, of these, still only a minority has wireless internet, but this is coming fast now. Internet has resumed its progression. So in this lecture on Monday, I will analyze the recent processes of social and political challenge to power of the state and to power of the financial capital, in which internet and wireless communication are playing a decisive role. This is, in fact, building on a number of analyses that I have already presented in my book published last year, Communication Power, but the material that I'm going to present now is new research material and therefore new analysis. I'm basically grounding my analysis on my own fieldwork research in Spain and in California, and research by my students and research collaborators in different countries, as well as secondary data and recent publications that I will mention in a second. Now, there are many other similar movements to the three ones that I'm going to analyze. And by the way, each movement is so diverse that it's an arbitrary unit. It's simply to at least synthesize some of the observation. But there are many other similar movements, and I would argue that they are also significant in many ways. For instance, the one European movement that has prompted major political changes, and in which the internet also played a decisive role and is playing the same role, is Iceland. Iceland. Among other things, few people know that the Icelandic citizens are now writing a new constitution over the internet with a full participatory system after a project that was designed by 25 people elected by 850 people randomly selected from all over the country. And in the way toward this, they bankrupt all the Icelandic banks, nationalized the banks, renounced foreign debt, and sent the prime minister to jail. Don't get the ideas. So this is to say that this is exploding all over the place in different ways. By the way, not all over the place. We can talk about that. But there are revolutions, and the so-called Western world, basically the United States and Europe, and not so much in other developing areas. We can discuss why. But also, in 2011, there have been absolutely powerful movements in Greece, in Portugal, in Israel, the largest social mobilization of Israeli history, and with less intensity in all the other Western European countries, even in quiet, calm, detached England, as you can go to St. Paul's Cathedral and you see that they're still there. They are still there. In all cases, we observe the capacity of movements for self-organizing without a central leadership. This is systematic everywhere, on the basis of a spontaneous emotional movement. And don't put any positive connotation on what I say. I'm just observing that. Then we can discuss all the implications of this. But this is simply a direct observation, no central leadership, either hidden or not hidden, and based always on a spontaneous emotional mobilization. And in all cases, there is a connection between the internet and wireless networks, and also the mass media in different forms, feeding into each other and amplifying and connecting the movement locally and globally. Now, these movements, all these movements, certainly have taken place in the context of exploitation, oppression, abuse, fraud, and, of course, in the context of growing social tensions and social struggles. So it's not like the internet came and the movements exploded. No. We know all that. But these particular movements that we are talking about had been successfully able to challenge the power of the state and of capital for the time being through the processes that I am describing, in which the internet and wireless communication do play a major role. Now, this is certainly not the technology. But without this technology, it would not happen. At least we can agree on that. Without, and I will try to provide evidence of that in the case of Egypt. Without this technology, as movements as they have happened would not have happened. But this is not the technology. It's deeper sources. But it is not either simply a technology as a tool. It's technology as a cultural construction, because it's a technology of free communication. It's a technology of freedom coming from a culture of freedom, designed by a culture of freedom. That's why I want to remind you first, before going into the analysis of social movements, that the internet is, as all technologies, is designed from ideas and could have been very different. Computer networking and computer-based communication could have been very different. As the French, they have Minitel, much more advanced technologically at the beginning, which of course the state tells you how and when to communicate. And with the International Telecommunications Union was organizing international treaties between governments because computer-mediated communication would stop at the borders of each country. Can you imagine? In the meantime, the internet was doing its thing completely differently. How completely different? Well, again, was a cultural construction. And in my books on the internet galaxy, published in 2001, and then on my book on mobile communication, by 2006, I have provided the historical and analytical account of this process, which actually is a set of layers of cultural creations that altogether contributed to the creation and development of the internet. Simply as a reminder, started as a techno-meritocratic culture in the universities and in research centers, was deepened by the hacker culture. The hacker, remember, are the good guys, not the crackers, which are the bad guys, okay? So the hackers, the term hack comes from the people who were hacking at the MIT Artificial Intelligence Lab in the 1960s and 70s. And simply the hacker culture is characterized by the creation, technological or other, any other creation, for the sake of creation as an expression of the passion to create. You can be a hacker writer, a hacker artist, a hacker teacher, a hacker whatever. But of course, the most important thing in the internet culture was this particular culture, which was essential because created a number of technological innovations in Finland, in the United States, in Britain, in France, people who immediately would create something and put it on the web, including the creator of the web, because the web was extremely important. And the creator of the web, of course, was Tim Berners-Lee, who created the web in his spare time in the night when he was working at CERN. But he was not working as an advanced scientist. No, he was a documentalist. He was a documentalist. And to do documents better, he created the World Wide Web. And he did what? Immediately put it on the web for anyone to tinker with it and modify it. This is a well-known story. It's simply just trying to convey the image of this series of cultures that came one on top of the other together in collaboration with the users of the Internet who were also the producers of the Internet, created the networks that we now use. The hacker culture, the third layer was the virtual communitarian culture, the online communities of the early age, in the 1980s, in the Middle Ages, the 1980s. The entrepreneurial culture that started in the 1990s, we can make money out of it. But the entrepreneurial culture came from the techie culture, which came from all these other cultures. And the entrepreneurial culture, with exception of Mr. Gates, was also based on the same principles of open access, freedom of communication, etc., etc. Third, what I call the mobile communication youth culture, which is a specific form of youth culture that has sprung around the world on the basis of mobile communication networks, which is a culture which is characterized by what I call the construction of safe autonomy. We are autonomous. We can do whatever. We organize our networks, but still we can call mama, or mama can call us, which now is translated into the professional roaming around the world, but they still can call the secretary or the corporation. The corporation supposedly can catch them. So this kind of safe autonomy, that is autonomy with a leash, with a virtual leash, is also a very fundamental part of the new transformation of the Internet. Among other things, because wireless communication provides a critical feature to the whole system. It's not mobility. It's not mobility. The large majority of calls through wireless phones are proceed from home, work, or school, empirically, where usually there is a landline, not in the developing countries, but just in the Western world. Why so? Because the critical thing is permanent connectivity. Permanent connectivity is to be you and your network. You can always reach out. It's permanent connectivity rather than mobility, which includes, of course, mobility, because permanent means that when you are in the move, you also can do it. But the most important thing is permanent connectivity, the ability to connect and be connected anytime, anywhere. And then the sixth layer, which has been emerging in the last 10 years, is the social networking culture, which increasingly is on a mobile internet platform, which is fundamentally can be defined as the creation of networks on the basis of individuals and their projects. Again, platform, corporate, technologically, etc., but the networks are created and formed and the nodes are added and subtracted by the people who are engaged into this process. The Internet, remember, is a old technology. Of course, old or new depends on the age perspective. But it's a technology that was deployed for the first time in 1969. So it's already, 42 years old. But it only diffused widely, as we know, in the 1990s due to institutional factors, privatization of the Internet, to technological factors, the creation of the World Wide Web and other user-friendly technologies, and particularly all of those based on open source, and organizational change and cultural change in society at large. And these two are the most important. Organizational change. Networking, as an adapted, flexible form of social organization, became an imperative for both corporations and persons. Networking, that's why I wrote The Network Society, published in 1996, had become the form of organizing in the information age, and of course, there was the connection, was not one or the other, the connection between the development of communication networking technologies with the demand from society, from business, from everywhere, in terms of the need to network, both things at the same time. And on the other hand, cultural change. And I want to say one word about this because it's fundamental. Cultural change, that is the rise of a culture of autonomy of the subject, emerging from the social movements of the 1960s and 1970s, which, by the way, has been documented, has been at the source of the ideas that led to free communication technologies in the Silicon Valley area. We know, in terms of sociological research and sociological theory, that our culture in the last quarter of the century has been characterized by a rising emphasis on what Giddens called individuation and what I call autonomy, more or less the same. This is individuation in the Giddens and Beck sense. This is the culture that emphasizes the project of the individual as the paramount principle organizing, orienting her, his behavior. Now, this does not mean individualism. This is fundamental. It's not individualism. It's individuation, that is, I define my projects, not the institution of society, not the values of some other entity. I decide my life and I define my projects. Now, the project, my individuation, could be I'm going to have a great time and party all the time and get a sports car and use my Cambridge connections to work a lot but enjoy even more. Or I'm going to individuate myself to save the world, to save the whales to start with, and then to organize life according to different principles. If I can, I can make the revolution, but a non-violent revolution. So in other words, it's the definition of the project of your life in terms of yourself. This is individuation, not individualism. In some cases, individualism. In some cases, extreme solidarity. In some cases, extreme altruism and generosity. There are all kinds of different projects. But what is fundamental is a society in which, for a number of factors, there is the possibility and the widespread attempt by people to define their own projects. Now, not in the matter that everybody can decide their life. Individuation is built in the structure of society. It's built in new forms of working and business. It's built in new urban forms and in new urban patterns. It's built on the new patriarchal, on the new family, which is emerging from the ruins of patriarchalism, in which becomes a family of individuals. And because it's a family of individuals, even children have their own project when they are 12. And the whole value system means that, you can beat them out, but you are going to have problems. So, in other words, there is a series of processes that have been well analyzed by sociologists that all converge toward the individuation culture. And again, the practice of technology depends on the culture that is embedded in the technology. So what I'm saying is that it's a technology of networking in a society that functionally and organizationally requires networking, and it's a culture of individually defining your networks of communication because they are the networks of your life in a culture that is fundamentally developed around the process of individuation. It's a convergence between technology, organization, and culture. For instance, you want to one example of empirical analysis on this in 2002, from 2002 to 2008, I developed what is probably the largest empirical research project done in Europe on the transformation of the network society in Catalonia. There were 55,000 interviews, of which 15,000 face-to-face, and huge sets of projects on everything from society to hospitals to schools to universities to business, etc. One of the results that we were able to provide is that we actually measure statistically the relationship between uses of internet and autonomy. We built a series of indicators of autonomy on different dimensions. We defined, and we actually did it by proceeding with factor analysis, and we had six factors, all traditional, standard statistical analysis. We built an indicator. One factor was professional development. Another was communicative autonomy vis-à-vis the mass media. The other was business entrepreneurship. The other one was autonomy of the body. The other one was socio-political participation. And the other one was personal autonomy. We showed statistically that each one of these six factors were statistically independent. So we were not measuring the same thing again and again. Were six different sets of autonomy projects. And then we showed that both in terms of frequency and intensity, the more autonomous, of course, most people in the society rank low, in terms, score low in terms of autonomy. About 25% of the population in 20 to 25, depending on dimensions, were autonomous, high autonomous. And we showed that the more autonomous an individual was, the more he or she would use the internet. And the more he or she would use the internet, the more would strengthen and develop his or her autonomy in a time sequence. So this has been it's not rocket science, because most people have been saying this for a while, but I did show for the first time that empirically that was the case. So the internet is based on a culture of autonomy, and this was the foundation of a very important phenomenon, the fast spread of social networking sites after 2002. And the social networking sites, it's really based on choosing the networks and or building new networks in terms of multidimensional affinity on connection online and offline. And in most cases, of course, on the basis of real identity. And the point is, social networking sites are not and were never just to find friends, to chat, to exchange cooking recipes, were instruments of life, are instruments of life, of every dimension of life, and of course also of socio-political life. And now everything from corporations, institutions, politics, ideology, business, everybody goes to the social networking sites. Not the social networking site to society at large, but everything and everybody to the social networking sites. Without, for that matter, that the society disappears. No, social networking sites had become one fundamental layer, dimension, of our life, which is not virtual, it's real, it's a different form of life. And it doesn't mean that offline life, face-to-face interaction disappears. No, we constantly live in a hybrid world in which there are different layers of equal realities, not virtual, it's real, is what I call real virtuality. Not virtual reality, but real virtuality. And that's where everything happens nowadays. Everything that happens in society has an expression and a presence in the social networking world. And also social movements. Right? So it's not that social movements were invented by the social networking site. It's on the contrary, social movements have used what people use anyway in their lives. But this has tremendous consequences. The most important consequence is that, therefore, there is an autonomous capacity for people to communicate, interact, build their projects, and develop their projects without direct control. We'll talk about the control later on if you want to discuss it, without direct control from either governments or corporations. This is it. It's communicative autonomy. And because autonomy is the basis for human action, human interaction, and human consciousness, and because communication is at the heart of this process, then this transforms the landscape of socio-political change and shows the possibility of emergence of what I call wiki social movements. Wiki, because of what you know, because they are largely spontaneous, no central coordination, developing cooperation, there is an interactive contribution, and it's a relentless configuration of the organization of the movement. That was always connecting and reconnecting as long as there is some glue, some unifying target, down with the dictator or down with the power of Wall Street. Or we are the 99%. Or we are indignant. Now, let me then go into a specific analysis of the Arab revolutions. By the way, I will not be covering in these two lectures the British riots of August 2011. I think it's a different animal, but I'm not entirely sure. So you tell me, okay? Because the main reason I'm not sure is I don't have enough hard evidence. And I don't trust the British press, period. Absolutely. I didn't trust the Egyptian press. I don't see any reason why the British press should be tried, or for that matter, the New York Times these days. Now, let's take a few minutes to reflect on the Arab wiki revolutions of 2011. Just one thing in terms of the sources, if you are interested. There I did not do my own fieldwork because just was too late for the semester having started already to change my life. But I relied on fieldwork by students and colleagues that I had online all the time with a number of secondary data. And this is more useful for you. I did organize the possibility of a set of 17 in-depth empirical studies that you have published now in the journal I co-edit with Larry Gross, the International Journal of Communication, the Spring 2011 issue. It's very easy. It's an online open access. It's ijoc.org, and you have 17 empirical studies on the Arab revolutions of 2011, which cover practically all the aspects. It was edited by two great scholars, Ilham Alagi and Johan Kubler, at our request. And they, I think they provide the most substantive database that you can have on this matter. You also have an interesting special issue of L'État moderne on the Arab Spring in May 2011. Well, but this is French intellectual reflections, okay? So you have to take it from that particular perspective. Don't expect any data. But it's very interesting. It's very interesting, very interesting. Truly, no, I'm really, I'm not ironic. It's very interesting, but it's not for data search. For data search, the IJOC special issue. One thing before that, in terms of the context. Philip Howard published last spring this year, a very important book. The title is The Digital Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy. I think it's an interesting title for those of you who remember Barrington Moore in the Middle Ages. The subtitle is Information Technology and Political Islam, published by Oxford in 2011. He did a comparative, this was before the revolutions, he did a comparative analysis of 75 countries, either Muslim or with a significant Muslim population. And he found that while framed by a number of contextual factors, the diffusion and use of information communication technology systematically favored democratization, strengthened democracy, and increased civic involvement and autonomy of the civil society. This was before the revolutions. So things don't appear just suddenly. I cite him, countries where civil society and journalism made active use of the new information technologies, subsequently experienced a radical democratic transition or significant solidification of their democratic institutions. Again, this is written before the revolutions. And it was very important that for him, the two countries that advanced most in this transformation were Egypt and Bahrain, which were high points of the revolution later. Now, naturally, the social uprisings that we observe took place as an expression of protest, general social protest, against dire economic, social, and political conditions. Unemployment, high prices, inequality, police brutality, humiliation. Humiliation, daily humiliation. That was extremely important. But from these objective, let's say, conditions, emerged emotions and feelings. Feelings of outrage. Feelings of, again, humiliation. These feelings were the ones that directly prompted spontaneous protest, often initiated by individuals, often by young people, using their networks. Why? Which network? The network where they do their life. All right? Now, before we go into any objection, but Egypt has no internet. Well, Egypt, the rate of penetration of Egypt at the time of the revolution was 25% of the population. The rate of mobile subscribers was 80% of the population. But the most important thing is not that. If you count an 80-year-old person in a village in southern Egypt, that's not the issue. The issue is that in the age group 16 to 40 in Cairo and in Cairo and Alexandria, there was 62% internet penetration, plus cyber cafes, plus schools, plus all different forms of internet penetration. So anytime you get all this dismissed by, well, look at the statistics about internet penetration. No, which internet penetration for whom and where? And that's what is absolutely critical. In Africa, if you don't count cyber cafes, you don't have internet almost. But go to the cyber cafes. That's where the young people are and doing all kinds of things. Now, but at the same time, these people use also their social networks offline. It was not only online, but it was the connection between the online and offline networks. Was the connection with the networks of family, very important, friends, soccer clubs. In Egypt was decisive. In Libya was decisive. One of the most important elements of the Libyan revolution was that the Benghazi soccer club had been systematically destroyed by the Tripoli soccer club owned by the Gaddafi family. So Real Madrid, Barcelona, you know, we are there. We are there. Now, it is in this connection which is exacted. And in addition, a precondition for the revolt was already the existence of a deep internet culture, rebellious internet culture in all the Arab countries. For instance, in Tunisia, there was a leading blogger journalist, Suher Yahyaoui, that he was in prison in 2001, 10 years ago, because of his criticism to the government in his blog, and died in prison. And I could cite many other examples. Furthermore, it's not only the internet connection, it's also the connection to some television networks. Al Jazeera was absolutely critical. Al Jazeera was present through satellite television, was present in 40% of Tunisian homes. And Al Jazeera saw the opportunity to actually connect these movements to Al Jazeera itself. How? On the one hand, Al Jazeera accepted quite systematically, without too much scrutiny, facts from YouTube uploaded by the demonstrators and the protesters. But second, more interesting, develop a technology in which the satellite from Al Jazeera would beam back information and images to cell phones. It's a different technology we know all the smartphones that can do that, but the cell phones that the majority of the population had. He changed the technology and provided a constant feedback loop between what people were sending to Al Jazeera and what Al Jazeera was sending to the people. And finally, in terms of the process, urban networks and urban communities were created on the basis of the protests in cyberspace. So from cyberspace to urban space, social networks, urban networks, and this constant connection was what created the movement. So let me go into the heart of the matter in terms of what actually happened. But I'm not going to go into the details because you have read many things that have been said, some real, some not. But in terms of the essence, as we know, the whole thing started in Tunisia, and that was the revolt sparked about the symbolic suicide of a young street vendor, Mohamed Bouazizi, in the town of Sidi Bouzid, who really killed himself because of the humiliation from the local police. Then both social networks and Al Jazeera broadcast the images of the repression of the protest against the death in the hospital already of this young man. And from there, the revolt extended to Egypt as a direct reflection of what happened in Tunisia, as an expression of the success that Tunisia had in terms of immediately challenging the dictator to the point that Ben Ali had to flee the country and was sentenced to long years in prison last month. Of course, he is not in Tunisia. But the important analytical matter is that this was the spark of the moral outrage that was clearly the origin of the revolution in Tunisia, through triggering a communication process that triggered a revolt process. But on the other hand, the other background is the existence of social struggles, and this is what, of class struggles, particularly working class struggles. And that's what I would like to convey to you. It's not one or the other. It's the added capacity of autonomous communication and autonomous networking on the basis of traditional forms of a struggle that were not able to make a dent on the regime, but became able when the struggle went from a limited social struggle to a broad movement that was spontaneous and articulated first on the internet in a space of autonomy that could not be immediately repressed and destroyed by the government. In the case of Egypt, what some people would say that the real Egyptian revolution started in 2008. Why? Because on April 6, 2008, well, in April 2008, in the city, in the textile industrial city of El Mahal El Kubra, north of Cairo, there was a gigantic strike of tens of thousands of workers in government-owned textile factories, in terrible exploitation conditions, which was savagely repressed by the police, killing dozens or maybe hundreds of people. It was the massacre of April 6, 2008. After that, a movement was created. Of course, a clandestine movement. It was the April 6th Youth Movement. That was very active, but could have been all the time decimated by the police. But look, this was the movement that in January 2011 was one of the most important appeals to revolt and demonstrate in Egypt. So you have a direct connection, except that he could do it on the internet, he could do it actually on Facebook, and was able to reach the population on the basis of a different context. Which different context? Tunisia. Tunisia. Why Tunisia? Because of hope, and I will come into this in a moment. The first demonstrations in Egypt had one unifying slogan: Tunisia is the solution, in Egypt. Now, this is significant. Why? Because the traditional Islamist call has been in Egypt and in the Middle East, Islam is the solution. The movements took to the streets directly countering that slogan with Tunisia is the solution, which doesn't mean that they were against the Islamists at all. The Islamists were a very powerful part of the movement, very powerful. But the idea was this is much broader. This is secular and religious. This is Islamist and non-Islamist. This is all together as people against the dictatorship. And the example and the reference was Tunisia. In parallel, empirically speaking, was a guy, a Google executive of all places, Vail Ghanim, who created a Facebook group in solidarity with Tunisia, got 60,000 people in 2 hours, and also called for demonstration. He became an unwilling hero because he was immediately arrested and disappeared for 12 days. People thought that was the first martyr, and he reappeared. And then when he reappeared, people say, oh, our hero, our leader. No leader. I was just there by mistake. I just said what people wanted. But actually, he was not a leader, but he was kind of a respected person because he really had played very strongly from the beginning. However, the most influential call to demonstrate on the 25th of January, the so-called Day of Rage, in Tahrir Square, came from a woman acting alone, by herself, Asma Mahfouz, a business graduate from the University of Cairo, who created a 4.5-minute video blog of herself, veiled, looking into the camera, and posted in her Facebook account this video. And from there, from that, her Facebook account was uploaded to YouTube and had immediate viral diffusion and came to be known in Egypt as the video that helped to spark the revolution. She actually posted 3 other videos until the end of February and were always very influential, acting by herself. No organization, no nothing. She used a provocative language, and for me, the most interesting part of it was that she was mocking and subverting patriarchal prejudice. Listen to this. She said, whoever says women should not go to the protest because they will get beaten, let him have some honor and manhood and come with me on January 25th. If you have honor and dignity as a man, come and protect me and other girls in the protest. So he's turning around prejudice rather than blasting prejudice, using prejudice to bring the people together into the street. In Egypt, the spark was composite of 2 emotions, indignation and hope. Indignation because of the constant abuses and repression from the police to workers, cyber activists. One of the key elements was a blogger who had exposed the police corruption on YouTube, was beaten and killed in front of the other people in a cyber cafe in Alexandria. Hope is a mobilizing emotion. This is important. Hope is a mobilizing emotion that we know from neuroscience research. Fear is a paralyzing emotion. But fear is the most potent human emotion. This is established by the neuroscientists. Why? They think it's a matter of evolution, of the species. Why? Because those who were fearless didn't run fast enough and were eaten up by the beasts. So we are all the heirs of cowards, fundamentally. Only our ancestors survived, and only our ancestors were cowards enough not to face something that they could not escape from. But therefore, it's paralyzing. And the whole world works on fear. Fear of losing your job, fear of not finding a job, fear of breaking up your marriage even if you're not happy with it, fear, of course, of facing the dictator, fear of being considered a weird person, fear of everything. The whole so-called civilization is based on fear. And instilling fear and reminding you every time all the terrible things that could happen to you if you depart from the established canons. But fear can be overcome, fortunately, otherwise we'll still be systematically under dictatorships. Fear can be overcome also, according to neuroscience research, by 2 elements: anger and togetherness. Meaning when the anger is very deep, overcomes fear because you cannot take it any longer. Anger, in the case of Egypt, has been also documented, came when people saw their friends and people like them being beaten and shot at in the streets. and also in the case of Tunisia. Togetherness is like we are all trembling together, but if we are together, if I can hang on you and you can hang on me, and we are together, we feel some power. We feel the power of togetherness. This is what all the history of revolution has been. Feeling this community of something in which together is we are not alone. We can actually survive if we stay together. When people overcome fear through anger plus togetherness, then two other emotions take over. Hope. The Tunisia thing was critical. Hope. Tunisia did it. We can do it. I were more on Egypt myself. And enthusiasm, which is a mobilizing emotion. Because if you are enthusiastic and you have hope, then everything is possible. And in this sense, the essential matter was the formation of a community, of an autonomous space that started in cyberspace and came into the streets. And Tahrir Square became the spatial, concrete expression of what had been created in the networks, but then landed in urban space and formed a community. As in history, the barricades, always in any popular insurrection, built a space that defines an in and out. Barricades have no defensive role. On the contrary, you are trapped. I have been in a barricade in Paris years ago. In the barricade, you are trapped. But it's something that you are trapped with your people. And those who are not in the barricades are not your people. Of course, the key of the movement is how the people who are not in the barricades at one point say, well, I may be interested in supporting those people who are so courageous. And that's exactly the in and out relationship. But the most important thing in the particular case of Egypt is that this space, this urban space, Tahrir Square, became the only significant form of self-organizing and actually started the movement that we are seeing today, which always end up trying to occupy a symbolic space, has to be a symbolic space, not a convenient space, but a symbolic space where you are there, you are together, and you see that you exist. It's not necessarily to say that the space disappears, the occupation disappears, and the movement disappears. No, but in the formative stages of a movement, the existence of this particular communal space is fundamental because it's creating a new culture of solidarity, it's debate, it's dialogue, and that the interface between the webs and the urban space is what constitutes the new forms of social movement. In the case of Egypt, particularly important was the existence in that space of many women and their children in the building of the local community, because women and their children insisted systematically on non-violence, which usually is the business of women, non-violence. And the non-violence is a fundamental principle in this movement, because the moment you cross the threshold of violence, we'll talk a little bit later about this in Libya, the moment you cross that threshold is army against army. And then all the, let's say, normal people don't want to die, don't want to see their people die. Now, the fact that women and their children were there was a direct expression of nonviolence. You still can be attacked, you still can be injured, you still can be killed, they were. But you are nonviolent. And in the formation of this community in Tahrir Square and the connection between Tahrir Square and the other urban spaces and the net, internet and internet networks were absolutely crucial. As often happens, traditional intellectuals, particularly left-wing intellectuals, for instance in the New Yorker, immediately say, come on, revolutions cannot be tweeted. Revolutions could not be televised. Now revolutions cannot be tweeted. In these cases, to engage in ideology is a lost battle. What we are really interested in doing is researching what really happened. And look in the journal that I mentioned, a very detailed study, quantitative, mathematical, by Gilad Lotan and a number of other authors that is titled "The Revolutions Were Tweeted." Information flows during the 2011 Tunisian and Egyptian revolution, in which they actually map out all the information flows from tweets and show the chronological connection, the geographical connection, and the relationship between moments of the movement, types of mobilization, and the dynamics of tweet flows. And then we know the revolution were tweeted. From there, we can start making other conclusions. And instead of spending time convincing intellectuals who don't understand the internet that they still can do something for the world without necessarily undoing the internet, the importance of the internet. The key element, therefore, in the social movement that followed in other countries coming from the Egyptian experience was the occupation of a space as a sign of the existence of protest. And again, in the case of Egypt, no leadership, self-organization, networking, and this means that repression cannot be selective, cannot arrest the leaders, cannot go after the usual suspects. There were no suspects. Everybody was suspect. And therefore, the repression could not be selective, had to be swift and brutal and massive. And they tried. They tried. That was why it was so important to stay together. To stay together means if they want to repress you, they are going to repress all of you. And that's possible, but sometimes it's difficult. And in the case of Egypt, it was difficult. The state tried. And by the way, referring to the theoretical framework I presented yesterday, remember, the most important way of building power relationships is shaping the human minds, shaping the minds. But it doesn't work all the time. In the case of Egypt, it was out of control. The Egyptian mind were already not buying the Mubarak leadership, the notion that only Islam could save. There has been a cultural, mental, political change. Then the tool of last resort is the monopoly of violence, legitimate or not. And therefore, in Egypt, as everywhere else, and one day here, anywhere, violence from the state is the ultimate barrier. Like with Mayor Bloomberg in New York yesterday, the day before yesterday, the same thing. Ultimately, you call the police, and if the police need some coverage, you have enough legal arsenal so that the judiciary also will back you up. So, in the case of Egypt, was outright repression after a while by the police, also the famous charge of the camels in Tahrir Square. There was media censorship, complete media censorship, and I will come to this, blocking of the internet. Now, the problem for the repression in both Tunisia and Egypt is that the armed forces played a key role by not backing the police or the thugs from the government. Absolutely key role, which, by the way, is at the same time the contradiction of the current process of political change in Tunisia and Egypt. But the army in Egypt had some prestige and was called upon by the demonstrators, and the army decided to preserve its image of the national institution beyond specific factions for one big reason. They have a business empire. It's the most potent business group in Egypt. So business was good. And business doesn't like turmoil. Business doesn't like instability. So why to start blooding the streets of Cairo, kill hundreds, maybe thousands of people? That was not a good business. To defend what? To defend this dictator that was ailing, basically out of the ability to control anything. And something else. The U.S., in this particular case, put pressure. And has a good pressure. It's $2 billion a year for the Egyptian army. And also, the U.S. was still, maybe still is, but was still in the mood of the Obama speech in Cairo, Go for Democracy, the Arab World, and of Hillary, January 2010 speech on the internet, which is a wonderful speech. I wish it would be true, but it's really a wonderful speech because it's literally the U.S. has to change its policy pro-democracy rather than just telling people to be to go into a democracy. We have to support the internet explosion, the internet use everywhere. Because if people have the internet, many things open up, civil society can express itself, etc., etc. Which I think is really, that's Hillary calling. I told you, wait 1 second, okay? So the reason for that, therefore, was to preserve at a relatively low price, one dictator less, the possibility of still influencing the notion of new democracy, new freedom in the Middle East to fight Islamism. That's smart. That's smart. This administration knows that you keep pushing people. There's no ways open in society. It's the Keppel's analysis on Islam. If you keep pushing people and no political ways out, you are not going to be able to control the radicalization of Islamism, and things will be much worse. So the army was literally told, this I know through connections, they were literally told, don't shoot them. Don't do it. Don't do it. And once this is done, the police itself, against the large mobilization of almost the entire society, could not handle the situation. And ultimately, the police started to strike to be able to keep their jobs in the post-Mubarak period. Similar things happened, by the way, in the case of Tunisia, in terms of France changing completely its policy vis-à-vis Ben Ali and decided that they have to abandon Ben Ali before things would be worse. Because in the case of Tunisia, besides the spontaneous social movement, a very powerful factor was the Tunisian trade unions. That is, Tunisian trade unions, particularly the Union Générale des Travailleurs Tunisiens, mobilized strongly together with the spontaneous demonstrators from the internet networks. When repression fails, the movement then is strengthened, and the regime is dramatically weakened. But I want to use the case of Egypt to understand one particular important process. What happens when you kill the internet or try to kill the internet? Because all we are saying is that the internet is the fundamental platform of networking, coordination, debate, mobilization. Well, switch off the internet, right? That's what the government would say. That's in fact what some politicians in Britain are saying after the riots of August. That's also what some congressmen in the United States are proposing. In the United States, there is a project called the killing switch, which is to find a technological way to have you push a button and off the internet immediately in the United States in case of emergency. There's some legal difficulties and constitutional difficulties to do so, but they are thinking about it. Because it's total panic, I can tell you, in the political class in the world about this thing. Because if people can organize themselves, debate themselves, do the thing, regardless of any legal control established by the government, that's very dangerous. This is the worst thing that the panic that politicians have at this point is that they will be occupied themselves. Therefore, in Egypt, for the first time, there was an attempt to shut off the internet completely for 5 days. Not even in Iran. They did. In Iran, they shut off the wireless communication networks in 2009, but not the internet. Not the internet. In Syria, they didn't. The reason for that is that both Iran and Syria, they wanted to see who was doing what in the internet and go after them personally. But yes, you catch one, two, three, 3,000. But when you have millions, you lose the battle. Now, what happened in the case of Fiji? First, it was a very simple business, relatively simple to do it. Why? Because there, in Egypt, there were only four major internet service providers. So they didn't do any technologically sophisticated matter. They called the four companies and said, you know, either you shut it off or we kill you. So they shut it off. But since that was such a direct and non-sophisticated method, in fact, they cut off 93% of the internet traffic. It's a lot, but 93% was not total blackout to start with. Then what happened? That's the interesting point. What happened is what is happening and will happen every time from now on. The global internet community came to the rescue. The global internet community came to the rescue through a number of systems. So to give you some examples, the Onion Router, which is a major anonymous network of connection organized by hackers, provided direct connections between landline telephones and mobile phones from Egypt and mobile phones in Egypt via the Onion Router, which anonymizes the traffic and provides connections. Ham radio was widely used. Google and Twitter, interesting revolutionaries, organize a system called Speak to Tweet, in which a telephone number, an international telephone number, could be called from a landline, and then with a voicemail recording, that message, voicemail, was transformed into a tweet automatically that would reach all the tweets in Egypt. Yes, it's only we're only about 14% of population with tweets, but again, in a special group, the Twitter was a much more was much higher, and so tweets received these messages. For me, the most interesting one is remember, landlines work. You cannot shut off landlines. I mean, landline telephone, the country in any country cannot work. The police cannot work. The most interesting example is there was a Swedish-based hackers group network called Telecomix, which is very, very sophisticated, who designed a program in which first they had a system of receiving messages through smartphones being used as modems and then landlines to a particular number. And from there, the messages would be sent in the following way back to Egypt. They designed a program that, using Google, found all the numbers of all the fax machines in Egypt. So all these programs automatically, all these messages automatically were forwarded to all the fax machines in Egypt, which were everywhere, including, of course, Mubarak's office and the police. And so Mubarak got huge numbers of faxes. But that was not the purpose. The purpose was not to do a clandestine operation, not the purpose. The purpose was to keep people connected all the time, to keep the messages going on, and being able to restore communication. So after 5 days, so it's important, and the internet community is doing this systematically in every moment of repression. They did it, they are doing it in Syria, they did it in Libya, they did it in every country where the internet is trying to be shut off. You have zillions of very sophisticated hackers with good equipment which are taking on anyone trying to shut off the internet. This is what I call a social movement of a different kind, which is internet and is offline, and it's global and it's local. The other reason they shut off shutting off the internet did not finish the communication was that the mainstream media, particularly television, kept working through satellite television, certainly Al Jazeera. But even the Western media were covering, because that's another point about having an urban space occupied. It offers great footage for the media. The reporters can go there. They feel excited by the revolutionary atmosphere. And then, particularly as it happened to CNN and BBC, they get beaten up by the police. And then when they get beaten up by the police, then it's personal. And then they start saying more things than what they should say. They start broadcasting. And, of course, all of this goes into satellite television. And then people systematically don't even watch the Egyptian television, but they watch all the satellite television, particularly the broadcast that went to a number of mobile phones that were working in networks. But, of course, the most important reason that the government surrendered and restored the Internet after 5 days was a little reason. They were losing $100 million per day, the Egyptian economy. So this could not be sustained for a long time. Many activities had been completely disrupted. Tourism, for instance, was completely disrupted. Egypt has a huge industry of subcontracting data processing that was shut off. So it's not like the Internet you can say, well, this is only for revolutionaries. No, it's the infrastructure of our society. So if you shut off the Internet, you suffer the functional and economic consequences quite significantly. But the other thing is that it was too late anyway. When you already have the people in Tahrir Square, when you already have a national crisis, an international crisis, and all the media there, it's too late. Even if you shut off the Internet for a while, the movement is not going to stop. And we'll find all these connections and all these networks at the urban space level to keep going. So, of course, the lesson of this for regimes is that, therefore, the Internet should be shut off permanently. Too late. Or China, Chinese model. Well, let's keep watching. Keep watching. Keep watching. Everyone in the Internet. Well, first, they cannot. They cannot watch everybody. But the main thing is that they don't have really a social movement of this kind. We'll see. We'll see what happens in the future. I don't do futures, but so I cannot tell you. But what I'm telling you is that until now, the Chinese example doesn't count because they have never faced a similar process. Because the social revolts in China are peasants, are urban dwellers being evicted from their homes, and workers committing suicide in their factories because of the rates of exploitation. It's traditional social struggles. In that sense, the Internet doesn't play much of a role. So we'll see. But again, what is clear is that the control of the Internet is an important preventive measure. But once the movement has started already with Facebooks and Twitters and social networks, then it's extremely difficult to change it. So let me finish by trying to summarize the key elements of what we have learned. Well, first of all, there were other Arab revolutions beyond Egypt, of course. And it was also important to see that the combination of indignation and hope in other countries spread the movement. Was really the Tunisia inspired Egypt. Egypt inspired Bahrain and Syria, etc. So it was really spread. You can have a direct timeline connection between all these revolutions, and all started by social networking, calls in the Internet. It was exactly the same process. That's why I don't want to fatigue you with the empirical explanation, and we don't have time. But what happened in Egypt vis-à-vis Tunisia happened in all the other countries vis-à-vis Egypt, and the more the movement spread, the more the process was similar. What was not similar, I mean, similar in the sense, Internet connections first, then occupation of urban space, then clashes with the police, then attempt to open up to other segments of the society, negotiating with the national armies, etc. What was different, of course, is that each country has a specific social, national, and geopolitical situations. And these other factors led to very different outcomes. For instance, in Morocco and Jordan, the kings had some legitimacy, and this led to, they opened up channels of negotiation, and they started some kind of reforms. Some kind, we'll see. But in any case, the attitude was not to repress, but let's talk about it. Algeria, there's no real movement. And what happened in Algeria was to tighten up control, period. Saudi Arabia has a very weak opposition movement, but the Saudis were ruthless in suppressing any possible revolt with the full support of the United States. Absolutely full support of the United States. Look, Saudi Arabia, you don't joke. This is our lifeline, meaning oil, of course. Yemen is very complex confrontation between tribal struggles. And in addition, there is a very strong, it's the only country where there is a real Al-Qaeda movement going on. And therefore, Saudi Arabia decided that they should not bring Yemen, the dictator of Yemen, down, and they are still negotiating under which conditions the conservative faction of the army takes over. The Emirates, they were able to generally to preserve their stability on the basis of what they are, a minority elite with a large foreign population. And therefore, the citizens of the Emirates were not inclined to risk their wonderful living conditions, and there was no movement except, of course, Bahrain, which is a major one. But that's because of the split between the dominant Sunni and the majority of Shiite, who are, because of they are Shiite, they are under suspicion and under control. And in Bahrain, there has been a very violent repression, even if the movement started on the internet, same thing, very violent repression. And some people don't know. Most people know that the Saudi troops were the ones controlling Bahrain and sending elite Saudi armies to Bahrain. But what people don't know is that the Pakistani troops had been deployed in Bahrain because they are much more effective and cheaper. In Syria, we know, has been and is a grassroots movement, originally with minority components, religious minority and ethnic minority, but has been going on. But why did not happen in Syria, even now, the same thing that happened in Egypt, meaning why the armed forces would not be called upon? Well, first, because unlike in Egypt, the armed forces in Syria always had been under tight control from the Ba'ath Party. And therefore, it's a much more unified regime at the top. But much more importantly, because when foreign powers support forcefully a dictatorship, it's much more difficult to unsettle that dictatorship. And in the case of Syria, you have Iran, China, and Russia supporting all the way the Syrian government. And when they decided to drop it, they will negotiate with the West, but not before. And of course, the counterexample of all this is the Libya scenario, that in which a movement that started very much like in Egypt was completely changed by the dynamics of tribal confrontation, the fact that the regime had a social basis, and much more important, the immediate geopolitical interference from the Western powers, for whom Libyan oil was as untouchable as Saudi oil for the United States. And that, under such conditions, rather than a social movement or a revolution, became a civil war, with all the sequels and problems of a civil war. So it's again a different situation that started with the same time of movement, but evolved into something else. The provisional outcome of these movements, the beginning of a democracy in Tunisia, clearly gone by the movement, with moderate Islamism in power. Rachid Ghannouchi, I have been following him for quite a while, and I don't resist to cite what I cited from him in my book, The Power of Identity, written in 1997, and I cited one of his interviews, which Ghannouchi said, "The only way to accede to modernity is by our own path. That which has been traced by, for us, by our religion, our history, and our civilization." In other words, what is now called the Turkish model, right, the Erdogan model, in fact was the Ghannouchi model, way before. moderate democratic Islamism. Well, that's what is now clearly hegemonic in Tunisia. In Egypt, as we know, Mubarak is on trial. However, there is still a democracy under surveillance of the army. As recently as today, the United States issued a warning to the Egyptian army that don't even dream about staying in power forever. That's today. The tensions, there will be elections, clearly. The issue is how clean. And the tensions already start with the Muslim Brotherhood. But the Muslim Brotherhood is a very mature party that also wants the Erdogan model to reach power through elections and therefore to be coexisting with all the other forces. There were hopes of a new relationship with Israel in the squares of Cairo and Tel Aviv, the two movements, but of course you can imagine with all the people, Egyptians, Israelis, and Palestinians, who live out of confrontation and for decades, this has been immediately ruined through provocation. And yet, the sacrifice of a Tunisian street vendor and the call of an Egyptian young woman on the internet have induced more changes in the Arab world than 50 years of domestic and international confrontation. And in that sense, all this was possible because suddenly people dare to construct their networks of freedom on the basis of technologies of free communication. Thank you for your...